Welcome to the Simmons Energy Piper Sandler call titled Perspectives on EVs and Renewables, Impacts to Conventional Energy. My name is Pierce Hammond, and I am a senior research analyst at Simmons focused on renewables, infrastructure, and midstream. Joining me today are Cashy Harrison, senior research analyst focused on renewables and natural gas, and Alex Potter, senior research analyst focused on transportation technology. The call is designed to be no longer than 30 minutes, and therefore we will not have time for audience questions. If you have any questions following the call, please reach out to me or your Simmons Piper representative. As a reminder, this call cannot be referenced in any articles, and this conversation should be considered off the record. And with that, let's go ahead and start our discussion on electric vehicles, so EVs. And pleased here to have Alex Potter, who is our analyst that's focused on this particular area and has deep expertise in it. And so, Alex, my first question to you is, detail your EV growth expectations, and what does EV market growth look like over the next decade, and what are the puts and takes on achieving those targets?
Perfect. Okay, thanks a lot, Pierce, and thanks for everybody for joining as well. So EV growth and penetration, you know, this is probably one of the most common questions we receive. And I know everybody generally just wants to hear a number, something like 30% electric vehicles by 2030 or something like that. So that's what I'm going to go with off the bat here. That's our rough expectation, is that 30% of all new vehicles sold will be fully electric by 2030. But in reality, I think that most of these medium and long-term forecasts end up being pretty useless. And our forecast, frankly, is no exception. Forecasts even from just a few months ago are already being revised, generally upward, because there's such a long list of these pro-electric vehicle targets that keep coming out from automakers or government officials. And, you know, so I think you have to take a lot of those things with a grain of salt. One of the, you know, relatively large underlying assumptions here is that companies other than Tesla will actually succeed at selling electric vehicles absent any government intervention or subsidization. And that's still a relatively unproven thesis. So, yes, these companies are very good at putting out press releases, but nobody really knows if consumers are going to actually be buying these vehicles 5 or 10 years from now. And we don't even really know what those vehicles are going to be. So rather than trying to, you know, specifically quantify the penetration, I think what I try to do is focus on statements that I think are going to be true no matter what happens between now and 2030. So one thing that I think is going to be true no matter what, there's roughly 80 million cars sold every year, regardless of drivetrain type globally. The U.S. and China and Europe are the three biggest markets. I think that more or less the sales in the U.S. and Europe have maxed out, and they're probably going to continue trending lower over time, but that will, in general, be offset by growth in China. So second thing that you can hang your hat on is that there's pretty well-established segmentation in the auto market. About 15% of all those 80 million vehicles sold globally are sold into the luxury segment. That's the most attractive category for early EV adoption due to lower price sensitivity. And then the final thing that I think that you can more or less guarantee over the next decade, or at least over the next several years, is that Tesla is really the only company that offers all of the requisite products and service and sales and charging capabilities that are arguably needed to sustain long-term demand. So those three general rules, take those as a backdrop, we're able to produce what I think is a relatively defensible outlook for Tesla's sales figures in the coming decade. And I personally think that that company is going to be selling around 9 million units a year worldwide by 2030. So that would make Tesla one of the top three automakers globally. And if you think that global auto market will still be producing around 80 million units in 2030, then Tesla's 9 million units would represent, roughly 11% EV penetration all by itself. Then there's a question of how successful other OEMs are at selling their own electric vehicles. And like I said, jury's still out on that. But if Tesla sells 9 million, and let's say that represents 40% of all the electric vehicles sold globally, then that would get you to that roughly 30% global EV penetration by 2030.
Well, excellent, Alex. That's very, very helpful. And then a follow-up question regarding EV battery types. What types of current technologies are best, and where do you see this going? And are there constraints on materials to be aware of?
Okay, yes. So lithium-ion batteries, I think, at this point, they're absolutely the go-to technology. But within that category, there are a few different chemistries to be aware of. The simplest and the cheapest of all of these is called lithium iron phosphate, or LFP is the acronym that you'll hear frequently. There are some drawbacks to this chemistry. It's not as energy dense. You don't get as much range. But like I said, it is very cheap relative to the other chemistries, and it avoids some of the problematic raw materials that are an issue for some of the other chemistries. Even Tesla now in their units in China are starting to use LFP batteries, which, you know, I think several people may have been surprised to hear a couple of years ago. So then you move beyond LFP. There's lithium batteries that contain cobalt, and cobalt is a really great material. I think all else equal, I think Tesla and others would continue to prefer using batteries that have cobalt, but something like 70% of the world's cobalt comes from problematic regions in Africa. It's just too difficult to secure supply ethically and at a reasonable cost. So people have been looking for ways to engineer cobalt out. Most current iterations of lithium-ion batteries have been able to reduce cobalt utilization almost entirely, but they still do rely on nickel. And that apparently is the next potential source of supply chain bottlenecks several years down the line. This is something that Tesla has focused, that Elon Musk has focused on in his Twitter feed. That company is apparently setting up a plant in Indonesia because of the nickel supply there. Looking longer term, the holy grail here is solid state battery. You know, that's headline candy. You see a lot of mentions in the press about solid state batteries. There are several high profile companies out there working on that technology, but at this point, there aren't commercial products that have solid state batteries yet. So certainly something to keep an eye on over the next several years, but as of now, it's all lithium ion.
And then Alex, what are your thoughts on commercial EVs? How will its adoption compare to personal EVs, and which sectors are going to be the biggest users?
Yeah, so I actually really like electric vehicles for some commercial trucks because the duty cycles are really well suited to electric drivetrains. But that's definitely not the case across all types of trucks and all types of buses. So I think in general, if you want to gauge the theoretical payback for an electric truck, you need to consider the following several items. You know, the first one, daily driving range. Ideally, it's, you know, at or below 100 miles. Rather than 400 or 500 miles, sort of Smokey and the Bandit long-haul trucking. Shorter the range, the better. Second, you know, does the vehicle come back to a centralized location after every shift? If so, that's ideal because you can charge it slowly overnight when the vehicle is idle and you don't need really fancy fast charging infrastructure. Item number three is, does the vehicle drive in stop-and-go traffic? And that's actually a really good thing. It maximizes regenerative braking and boosts efficiency versus cruising down the highway. And then the fourth is the buyer, right? Ideally, you want a municipality, a school district, or some other sort of quote-unquote motivated buyer who's environmentally conscious, less sensitive to price, maybe access to grant money. If so, that's sort of your ideal early adopter. So if you put all of that together, I mean, I think it's easy to see why the ROI and the initial uptake is best for things like municipal buses or school buses, garbage trucks, and other types of work trucks, vocational applications. I wouldn't be surprised over the next, you know, 5-10 years if you start getting very meaningful double-digit type penetration within those segments for electric drivetrains. The problem is that these are pretty niche-y markets, and there's, you know, the total addressable market size is measured in the thousands or maybe tens of thousands of units sold annually in the U.S. And as a result, it can be difficult to get the really big OEMs to focus on those segments. they're directing most of their R&D dollars toward electrifying bigger trucks, where the market size is, you know, bigger. It's measured in the hundreds of thousands of units annually. But the payback profile is substantially less attractive, and potentially some segments might never have a real positive ROI versus diesel. So it's a trade-off there, but I do think one way or another, if you extend out over a long enough period of time, you're going to have electric drivetrains penetrating very meaningfully in almost all commercial vehicle segments.
Well, great. Well, thank you for that perspective, Alex. And we will return to Alex towards the end of this call with a few more questions on EVs. What I'd like to move to now is the solar sector, and Kashi Harrison is our analyst that's focused on that sector. And so, Kashi, what's been behind increasing interest in solar?
Thanks for the question, Pierce, and thanks, Alex, for that rundown, and thank you, everyone, for dialing in. So, you know, increasing interest in solar is really just been driven by rapid cost reductions over the past decade that has made solar more competitive with, you know, fossil fuel generation. So specifically, when you think about the price of a solar panel, it's declined by probably about 80% between 2012 and 2020, as the Chinese, who dominate the manufacturing business, have just found various ways to, you know, to lower costs over time, various techniques. In addition to lower costs, we've also seen advancements in various technologies such as trackers and the emergence of bifacial panels, which have improved the power production of solar panels. And so, you know, when you look at the levelized cost of energy, or the LCOE metric, which is used to compare costs across, you know, various sources of generation by calculating the NPV of cost divided by the quantity of energy expected to produce over a system's life, you see that on LCOE, utility scale solar and wind are now the lowest courses of generation, even without the benefit of subsidies in the U.S. based on Bloomberg data. Now, it's important to note that LCOE metric certainly isn't perfect due to the intermittent nature of renewable production and mismatch relative to consumption. That said, it does provide some context as to how far solar has come over the past decade.
And Kashi, that's helpful color on how we got here, but how do you think about the opportunities and threats facing the solar sector nearer term and longer term?
Yeah, so near term, the obvious opportunity is growth. Based on Bloomberg New Energy Finance data, solar installations grew by over 20% during 2020, notwithstanding the challenges associated with the global pandemic. Installations are expected to grow by another 30% during 2021 on a global basis, and we'd expect that solid growth trajectory to continue as you look into 2022. Now, this robust installation demand has driven a surge in polysilicon and glass prices, which are key inputs for solar panels. Glass prices have moved to, you know, unsustainably high levels and are probably going to be down by the end of the year, which has solved that problem as new supply comes online. However, polysilicon prices could remain elevated for some time as they're, you know, just because of the demand that's out there and how long it takes to get some of these facilities up and running. Further, as most people on this call are aware of, there have been just awful, terrible human rights violations against the Muslim community in the Xinjiang province within China, which is where most of polysilicon supply and capacity in the world is. Recently, the House reintroduced a bipartisan bill that would ban imports from the region unless they are certified that they are not produced with forced labor. And so should other Western countries follow suit with the U.S., these actions could drive cost inflation as supply chains are forced to reorganize. So that's you know, those are some of the nearer term puts and takes. Longer term, you know, the story is relatively straightforward. Solar is going to be a story of massive cost reduction and massive growth.
Interesting. Very interesting, Kashi. And what do you find most exciting about the subsector?
Yeah, so right now I find myself doing most of my work on the U.S. Residential solar sector. I find that area particularly intriguing. So, you know, specifically, when you look at, you know, the deflationary tailwinds over the past decade, favorable incentives from the government, widespread public support from the communities, innovative financing. When you look at all those things put together, they've just driven massive growth in residential solar within the U.S. So, you know, at the end of 2010, there was, you know, residential solar is probably a rounding error. Today, residential solar is probably closer to 17 gigawatts of capacity, which is just a ton of growth over such a short period of time. You know, notwithstanding all the growth that we've seen, there's still only 2.5 million solar customers out there in the U.S., relative to 85 million homes based on EIA data. So the penetration is relatively low. And then, you know, when you think about the single family homes, they're supposed to grow from, you know, 85 million today to something around 105 million by 2050, according to the EIA. And so in theory, there's a large market opportunity to be grabbed over the coming decades. And so to place, you know, the potential opportunity into context, one in four houses in Australia today have rooftop solar. So, you know, the market opportunity is great, but another reason that I find myself very interested in the resi sector is because it does seem like, you know, we're running into these once in a 100-year weather events every single year, and they do seem to wreak havoc on centralized sources of power from utilities. And so the question is, you know, will these events drive increasing interest from customers seeking some sort of power resilience? And if so, then, you know, for starters, that's going to be great for, you know, natural gas generators, but it's probably also going to be great for storage over the long haul, for solar storage. And so, you know, that potential opportunity is one of the reasons why larger generator companies have actually invested within the storage business. Storage is still super nascent. It's still quite expensive, and, you know, we're not quite there in terms of getting you there through a multi-day blackout. However, as the costs move meaningfully lower over the coming decade, and more policies are put into place, then we'd expect more solar customers to opt for storage, which, you know, should be very interesting over time.
Cashy, that's a great summary of what's going on in solar right now. Thank you.
No problem, Pierce. You know, I guess maybe switching gears to you, I know you spend a lot of time on hydrogen and fuel cells. So, you know, if you could give us an update on that area, that would be fantastic.
Yeah, thanks, Cashy. Given the global decarbonization megatrend, hydrogen and fuel cells are seen as key tools to aid that trend. And so let's start with hydrogen. Hydrogen is a fuel that can be very flexible, as it can serve as a transportation fuel, as a fuel for power generation, as well as a feedstock for industrial processes. In addition, since hydrogen can be stored, which is not the case with electricity, which cannot be stored except for batteries or pump storage or compressed air storage, hydrogen is seen as a major pathway to storing electricity generated by wind and solar. Now, where policymakers see hydrogen playing a key role in the future is to be used as a replacement for fossil fuels in hard-to-decarbonize sectors like heavy industry. But there are challenges for hydrogen. First, hydrogen is a fuel that is created, meaning that it is not a fuel you can go drill for like oil or natural gas. Second, hydrogen is expensive. And third is the need for infrastructure to transport, store, and deliver the hydrogen. Now, hydrogen normally is manufactured by the methane reformation process using natural gas or coal as the feedstock. 76% of current hydrogen production in the world is from natural gas, and 23% is from coal. Hydrogen can also be manufactured using electrolysis, which is using electricity and water to split H2O into hydrogen and oxygen. Now, when you hear people talk about green hydrogen, they are referring to hydrogen produced from renewable energy, like wind and solar, using electricity and water, whereas blue hydrogen is hydrogen produced from natural gas, but where the CO2 from that process is captured. Now, at this point, hydrogen remains very embryonic, and there are a number of pilot test programs going on by both electric utilities and major oil and gas companies. The key is to get the cost down. It is important to note that the IEA believes there is no path to net zero emissions that does not include hydrogen. Now, we believe hydrogen currently is at the same state wind and solar were at roughly 10 to 20 years ago, but we do expect fast advancement in the hydrogen sector given the push for global decarbonization, the amount of capital raised to pursue hydrogen ventures, and strong investor and policymaker interests. Now, returning to cost, according to the IEA, the cost of producing hydrogen from renewable electricity, so that's green hydrogen, could fall 30% by 2030 as a result of the declining cost of renewables and the scaling up of hydrogen production. But keep in mind, the electricity requirements necessary for electrolysis are massive. Per the IEA, if all current dedicated hydrogen production globally right now were produced through electrolysis, this would result in annual electricity demand of about 3,600 terawatt hours, which is more than the annual electricity generation of the EU.
Well, that's a big number, Pierce. But that is very interesting about hydrogen. I was wondering if you could maybe share some more color about fuel cells.
Yeah, so Kashi, fuel cells are powered by hydrogen and produce electricity with no emissions. Think of fuel cells as similar to batteries, but they do not need to be recharged, just refueled with hydrogen. The decarbonization trend is also driving fuel cell deployment. Fuel cells are currently used in large-scale warehouse applications on forklift trucks as replacements for lead-acid batteries. In the future, you should expect to see fuel cells competing with batteries and other power generation sources for markets like backup power. One market that is very embryonic and is receiving a great deal of attention is fuel cells for heavy-duty transport like trucking. The lithium-ion batteries required to power a Class 8 truck are too heavy, and fuel cells are seen as a replacement for diesel engines in the future. This also applies to other heavy-duty markets like locomotives and marine. The challenge for fuel cells is to get the cost down. Currently, fuel cells are not cost competitive with internal combustion engines. Now, we expect cost reductions, carbon pricing, as well as greenhouse gas mandates should result in fuel cells becoming cost competitive with internal combustion engines over time. In fact, one of the leading fuel cell companies, Ballard Power out of Canada, is targeting a 70% cost reduction in the fuel cell stack and balance of plant by 2024. At this time, we're still early days into fuel cell adoption, and there's been a lot of capital raised, partnership struck, and research and development pursued. So to the audience, I would just say, you know, stay tuned. Now, I would like to come use this as a segue, as we were just talking about fuel cell vehicles, to come back to Alex on EVs. And as we move to wrap things up here with this call, we wanted to ask three questions pertinent to today's discussions. The first question is for Alex Potter regarding EVs. This past week, the Wall Street Journal published an excellent article about the EV market and highlighted that one of the major items limiting EV penetration is not only the lack of EV charging stations, but also the lack of fast charging. The article detailed that many stations do not have operable fast charging units. So, Alex, what are your thoughts regarding the barrier presented to EV penetration from the lack of reliable charging stations?
Yes, thanks, Pierce. I 100% agree. The Wall Street Journal and others are right to highlight this as a bottleneck. And this is one of the reasons why earlier I mentioned Tesla. They had gone out prior to achieving scale production with their own proprietary fast charging network that goes coast to coast. So if you are a buyer of a Tesla vehicle, this is something that you don't lose sleep over. If you are buying almost any other brand, it is something that you have to think very hard about. And it's less a function of where you're going to get your electrons on a day-to-day basis. At least here in the U.S., it's, you know, something like two-thirds or three-quarters of the people who buy cars of any kind live in a single-family home. They can do their charging in the garage. But everybody, even if you spend 95% of your time driving around town, every once in a while, you leave town and you go visit a friend, you take a road trip. And for those trips that inevitably are going to occur, you are going to feel nervous about where you're going to charge your vehicle up. This is something that I think the automakers themselves are starting to address in a concerted way. But I think the ones that are best positioned probably to address this are either specialized companies that are cropping up specifically to address electric vehicle charging, and specifically fast charging, or, you know, some of the incumbents, whether it's utilities or oil and gas companies, who understand how this value chain works. Something though, in a coordinated way is needed before we're going to be able to achieve escape velocity.
Great stuff, Alex. And then you have a very unique vantage point into China, given you speak Mandarin, you've traveled to China too many times to mention, and have excellent contacts in the country. Can you give us your quick assessment about EV trends in China?
Yeah, you know, I think that clearly you have a very top-down, command and control-oriented mentality in China, and I think a lot of folks, whether it's investors or everyday people, give the Chinese government probably more credit than it deserves when it comes to pushing electric vehicle penetration. I think at the end of the day, regardless of whether we're talking about China, the U.S., or Europe, vehicle manufacturers need to have products that consumers are willing to voluntarily buy instead of an internal combustion engine. You can, in the short term, as China has demonstrated time and again, juice electric vehicle sales in a temporary way by throwing a bunch of money at the market, but that's not sustainable. And in the end, if the product isn't compelling enough to stand on its own feet and compete against internal combustion, then consumers are going to gravitate away from it. And you've seen that occur multiple times. You are now starting to get to the point where there are EV-specific brands, sort of Chinese Tesla lookalikes, or in some cases, incumbent vehicle manufacturers who are coming out with products that appeal to consumers, Chinese consumers in particular. And I do think that the recent up and to the right trajectory of electric vehicle penetration in China is going to have more staying power than it did over the last, you know, call it 5-10 years when you had a lot of fits and starts.
Thanks, Alex, for that rundown. Really appreciate it. Pierce, if I could step in here and maybe have you wrap up today. You know, we only have 2 minutes left to go, but we've heard, you know, about some key areas of the energy transition, you know, specifically EV, solar, hydrogen, and fuel cells. And so, you know, what does this all mean for conventional energy? Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Gashi. As detailed extensively in a recent Simmons Energy Ruminations note authored by senior analyst Bill Herbert, our view continues to be that conventional energy will be characterized by accelerating and perhaps even cathartic cyclical reflation and normalization concurrent with accelerating secular headwinds. Renewable energy, on the other hand, is in the early stages of accelerating secular adoption. Now, the cyclical recovery for conventional energy will be driven by the convergence between the pent-up demand recovery for oil, so really catching back up to where we were from pre-pandemic demand, and then redefine upstream capital allocation, which should allow for a full normalization of OPEC plus spare production capacity and the inception of a global reinvestment cycle. So all that's positive for conventional energy. The key questions relating to the cyclical dimensions of oil are ceiling and duration. Now, with respect to ceiling, Brent WTI prices are hovering at $60 to $65 a barrel and up a little bit more today following the surprise Saudi decision to continue to hold back oil from the market. And drilling and completion costs have been exceedingly accommodating, which would seem to portend generous reinvestment and production growth at some point. But given the current capital allocation priorities of the global E&P value chain, it would appear that resource holders for the time being are being considerably less responsive to improving oil prices and cash flows than they have been historically. Conventional energy remains a relentlessly capital-intensive industry, and there's a growing belief and concern that the oil and natural gas value chain is underinvesting relative to the likely intermediate-term demand outcomes. Now, the duration question, though, is the most challenging. We are of the belief that the combination of demand displacement from EVs, which you've heard about here today, biofuels, and eventually hydrogen, as well as just disruption, the whole work from home, hybrid office models, and redefined and more intentional business travel, that all that coupled with increasingly assertive renewable energy government policy globally will lead to markedly decelerated rates of normalized oil demand growth beyond the pent-up demand recovery over the next 10 years versus the preceding decade. And I think that's a really important point about a markedly decelerated rate of normalized oil demand growth. And so the oil demand CAGR over the preceding pre-pandemic decade was about 1.5% per annum, whereas the IEA projects that the demand CAGR through 2030 will be about 50 bips per year. And while there are a wide range of estimates for an effective oil demand peak, most estimates land between 2025 and 2035. Now, energy, the equities, has been in the thrall of a rotation momentum since the Pfizer vaccine announcement in November. The convergence of reflating, normalizing demand with redefined E&P capital allocation and rationally normalizing OPEC plus spare capacity from exceedingly swollen levels is the recipe conventional energy enthusiasts and investors are embracing. So given the conventional energy dueling tensions between the cyclical and the cyclical is likely to outweigh the secular over the near to intermediate term. And then in our view, the most investable conventional enterprises, energy enterprises, are those that have a blend of a plausible energy transition story or optionality, and then full cycle free cash flow generating prospects. And so with that, we'll conclude today's call, and we hope it was helpful for everyone's that was participating. And so thank you again for attending today's call. A replay will be made available pending compliance approval, and you may now disconnect.